What's about after?
Quiet, please, ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one fat-ass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday. Always glad to take your calls on the Radio Northwest Network at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. There's a part of me that always wonders whether or not Brian Haywood gets tired of having people in Washington State constantly turning to him and saying, Brian, we got to get this thing on the ballot. Can you make that happen? Brian, welcome back. Do you ever get tired of those requests?
Not as long as people are willing to join me in the fight.
And that's it. Give their time, give their effort, give their money, perhaps, and do that as well. What do you plan to do with this ridiculous millionaire's tax that Bob Ferguson has signed into law?
Well, we've got a couple of things. The first thing that we did yesterday was we're challenging the whole idea of the referendum. They put in what's called a necessity clause, which is not in the Constitution. There's an emergency clause that they can do. And then I'm going to get in the weeds a little bit for your listeners, but
please do.
But the Constitution basically says that everything is up for a referendum, which means you can just straight up repeal the law that they make, except for things that the legislature deems as something with urgency or an emergency that are regarding the safety or the health of the state. And there's a comma there. And then it includes things that are to support the state institutions, existing institutions. And what the legislature has done is instead of having a comma, they've changed it to an or. And what that means is there is nothing that they can't say is an emergency. They don't even have to say it's an emergency. They just have to say it's in the interest of the state. And that makes them do something the Constitution doesn't anticipate, and that is have the right to choose that the people cannot have a voice on whatever they decide not to have a voice on.
Just as they say, this is a necessity, and you're going to challenge that in court first before you try to put it on the ballot, right?
Well, the first thing that we're doing is we filed a referendum. We're saying we have a right to file a referendum. There's no reason you can block it. There's no constitutional reason that you can block this. You can put whatever words you want in the bill, but they're not in conflict. They're not in alliance or compliance with the Constitution. They'll have to then challenge us and say, no, you can't do that. And then we'll challenge them back and take them to court if that's what we have to do.
Brian, you managed to put an awful lot on the ballot, and I've been thankful. And there isn't a single one of them that I haven't either signed or supported one way or another. So I guess what I'm wondering is you've got a pretty good read on what the voters want. I don't think at least the Democrats in the legislature seem to have a good sense of what the people of Washington want. Do you think there's any doubt that once this gets on the ballot, the voters will vote it down?
No, I think they will. The caveat is this. The SEIU 775 raises $80+ million a year off of the home health care workers. It's like unlike any other union in the entire United States. None of the people are allowed to organize, and it's just this money grift. And they're pulling in $80 million a year. If they decide to pound the airwaves with $80 million, we'll have a fight. Like, I don't know that we win if they pound us with $80 million.
Yeah, really?
If you just took.
I guess I'm wondering, when citizens hear this and they're told, well, this is only going to apply to millionaires, Brian, I've told them, I don't think there's any way that they stick to just millionaires. They're going to be dropping the limits on this as quickly as they can to capture people below a million, because an awful lot of the richer, you know, the more wealthy people in Washington State, all they have to do is move their state of residence away and the taxes go away, right?
You're absolutely right. And that's what our polling is showing us that as well, that we've looked at what do people think. And what we found is people that are not informed are more likely to believe that it might stay on millionaires. People that have been informed or have been following the issue. So how closely are you following this? people that are closely following the issue are at like 60-70% of them believe that this is going to apply to them as well.
Well, because one of the things... Sorry, Ryan, go ahead.
Go ahead. You're good. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I keep reminding people that the original income, not the original, it was actually the second income tax, but the one that's still in place nationwide today, came about with the taxing, you know, the folks behind it said, we're only going to tax the super rich, which had a different definition back then than it does today.
Right.
But they said, we're not going to tax average workers. It's going to be way above that, and it's only going to be a small percentage. And now, you know, there, to a large extent, anybody who works at a job and makes an income pays income taxes in America. And you say, how did we get to that? You say, you got to it by people promising it's only going to apply to the ultra rich.
And I think in Washington State, we're even worse off than we were back then, because we've got a legislature and a governor who know this is an unconstitutional tax. They are completely, completely ignoring the Constitution and pushing it anyway. They've basically said, oh, well, we know, but we'll let the courts make that decision. That's not their job. So we're starting off at a point of dishonesty. And then on top of that, you've got Jamie Peterson saying, you know, we don't keep any of our promises anyway.
The Mary Poppins pie crust promise. Yeah,
exactly. There's no way. Well, and let's take CCA as the other one. In this whole mess this year, the Climate Commitment Act tax. No, the world's going to burn. We've got to take your money at the gas now. And then they suddenly found, oh, well, it's not that urgent. We're going to raid that and pay for all the other crap that we're paying for in the budget.
That's what they tend to do, is they create a slush fund, yes. They say it's for this good purpose, and then once they find other things they want to spend money on, which they already knew they were going to spend money on them, they say, well, like you said, it's not a crisis after all. We can afford to divert it for any other project we want.
They're doing something else that's exactly right. They're doing something else that's dirty as well. In the current law that they just passed, in the intent section, the very top, the intent, it's our intent to use this to, you know, spend money to save people that are in these brackets, right? It's our intent to use this money on education, et cetera, et cetera. They don't have that in the law anywhere else. It's only in the intent section. There's no binding on them. But the reason that they do it is so that when they write a ballot title for whatever initiative that we end up challenging them with, the ballot title that the Attorney General will write and then the financial impact statement will say this will take money away from K-12, from expectant mothers, from, you know, it'll make this sound like it's the worst thing in the world on the ballot. And so that's the challenge that we need. We need people to be informed and to tell their neighbors, right? I mean, your listeners are people that the reason they listen to you is to be informed. We need them to use their voices and talk to their friends and neighbors that everybody knows this, that this is a fake promise and this is going to hit everybody.
I totally agree. And Brian, for example, right next door, Portland passed this crazy climate, you know, fund. They took in far more money than they thought they were going to take in. And then they said, hey, we've got a slush fund. Do you know they're actually talking about taking some of the money that was supposed to be, again, for saving the planet from global warming or whatever? They're going to spend part of it on remodeling the MODA Center, you know, to benefit the new billionaire owner of the Portland Trailblazers. That is Brian Haywood. He has managed to put ballot measures on the ballot successfully. He's challenging Bob Ferguson's new millionaire's tax in court on constitutional grounds and others, and it will be on the ballot. And you've got the Lars Larson Show. Do you have trouble?
If you don't want to talk but want to be heard, email Lars at talk@larslarson.com. He actually will read it. Now, here's Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday, and we're live on the Radio Northwest Network and now KRCW. I want you to imagine this. What if about 100 years ago, you were offered a deal? The federal government said we have a whole bunch of empty land that would grow things really, really well. So if you farmers would come on down and set up your farms and grow things here, we will make sure that you get the water. Now, that deal operated for decades and decades until the federal government decided to renege on the operation, and this year is one of the worst years. Klamath Basin farmers are going to get about half the water they need, and Oregon just got hit with one of its worst snowpacks on record, so I thought we'd talk to Gene Souza, who is the executive director of the Klamath Irrigation District. Gene, this is like old times. I can't remember how many years we've been talking about the Klamath Falls and the Klamath Basin situation, but welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Lars. Great to talk to you again.
I don't know what the farmers are going to do when they're being told you're going to get about half the water you actually need to be able to back up the farmers, because farmers don't have the kind of business you can put on hold. So describe for my audience what's going on.
Well, Lars, what happened over the winter is we got a little less than average precipitation. It wasn't horrible, but we got quite a bit of water that came into Upper Klamath Lake, which is our main storage reservoir. But we had really warm temperatures. Instead of that water staying up in a higher reservoir and remaining in snowpack, as you mentioned, we're having the snow drought. And right now, we basically have no snowpack remaining. When we should have peaked about a week ago, we should be having, with these warmer temperatures, all this water running into Upper Klamath Lake. We should be getting, based upon how it's been managed this year, should be getting close to flood control and releasing a bunch of water out of the system to go rehydrate the refuges and do a number of things that we can do when we got floodwaters. But unfortunately, that snowpack is gone, and inflows to Upper Klamath Lake right now are about 50% below what they are this time of year, all without that snowmelt. And what we have left in the lake, we have a good amount of storage in the lake, but we're still operating under Biden administration policies that he left with us in December of 2024, a departure gift, if you will. And under those Biden-era policies, we have to release more water out of the system into the ocean for those inbred southern resident killer whales, then water is actually coming in, and that's going to be a problem for us throughout the remainder of this growing season, and it's putting a pinch on our farmers and our ranchers in how we're trying to get through this year and get crops to market and provide food for our nation and food for the national economy.
Gene, is there any way for President Trump to be able to correct this parting gift that the mentally incompetent President Autopen left the farmers with? Because if the rules made under Biden, can it be unmade under President Trump?
Well, yes. I mean, we talked to the administration. I mean, days after President Trump took office, we were able to get a letter from the Secretary of Interior saying he's reviewed the situation here in Klamath, and we need to review all of the policies that were left with us. And he's done a great job. This administration has done a great job in identifying the issue, has identified and provided guidance to correct the issue. The problem is just the government wheels and the government structure, how things have to work so that we don't get ourselves into court, which is the worst thing we can do is get a temporary restraining order from one of these radical judges and say, we've got to stop all water to farmers. So as we're waiting for the federal employees to go through their process, follow the guidance that has been given to update their legal guidance and to actually look at what the law says, and then apply something that is within the scope of law, prudent here in the Klamath. Unfortunately, while I advocated to get this done as quickly as possible, I understand and I commiserate with being in a federal employee and having to go through steps and having to get every product reviewed. And, you know, you talked a little bit earlier about the swamp there in D.C.
Oh, God.
It's throughout the bureaucracy. It takes a lot of work to get a few pieces of paper approved. And by the time you get a piece of paper approved, it basically says nothing.
Okay, and that's even with a fairly decent Secretary of Agriculture in charge and answering Donald Trump's, you know, his charge to the Secretary of Agriculture, Brooke Rollins, if I remember correctly, yep. That even with all that pushing, how soon are we hitting kind of a drop-dead date? Because does the water have to flow by April or by May, or do we have a couple of months where they can get this worked out and still get you the water before the end of the growing season, or are farmers going to have to make the decision right now to idle 40,000 acres?
Yeah, the farmers needed to make the decision about 2 months ago, unfortunately.
Oh, God.
And while Secretary Rollins is she's great, she's awesome, She is doing a number of things, and we've stuck a number of papers on her desk, and she's following up on those. But unfortunately, we don't follow under Secretary Rollins because we're a reclamation project, so we're falling under Department of Interior under Secretary Burgum. And Secretary Burgum, of course, is great. He's got some great folks working for him. This administration has really showed that they care. They want to come in and do what they can. But what can President Trump and the administration do in the short amount of time? I've already got the A-Canal headworks open. We're charging the system right now. We're going to start delivering water to farmers on the 15th of April. Between now and the 1st of May, we're hoping that we get some updates from how the federal government would like us to administer their contracts that we have assumed. So in 1954, Klamath Irrigation District took all these contracts from the federal government, and it says you shall do this and you shall do that. And until the federal government tells me that I have a reprieve from those shalls, then my responsibility is to deliver that water. Now, here's the flip side. I can go start delivering that water right now, and the farmers get it off to a great start. They get their seeds started, the crops start growing. And if I'm not careful, if I over-deliver, or if we don't have enough water in the season, say July, and all that water stops, that is a ton of money that's in the ground that I feel personally responsible and on my shoulders to make sure that I don't let farmers put money in the ground and not get a return on their investment.
No kidding. Hey, Gene, one last quick question. Can the tribes give you any relief? They control some of that water, don't they? Or do they?
They could have some impact on this by being willing collaborators. The problem is that the Biden administration put some things in black and white on a piece of paper, and until that black and white piece of paper is rescinded to something new, all the environmental groups in the world can sue over that black and white ink.
Unbelievable. That is Gene Souza from the Climate Irrigation Show. Gene, thanks very much.
Portland's news, traffic, and interviews, podcasts, local and national news. Get it all at LarsLarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and emails. 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk at LarsLarson.com, and you can always vote in our X poll. Today, just for fun, on the X poll, should public schools digitally track every single minute a student spends away from the classroom and in the bathroom? Now, I think that all of us who've gone to public school, and I went to public school, remember the hall pass. Usually it was a block of wood or something like that. But when you went to the teacher and said, hey, I need to go to the restroom in the middle of a class, they'd hand you a hall pass. That gave you permission to be out in the hall. Well, now the New York City public schools are using something called Smart Pass. It is a digital hall pass system that tracks the students. It tracks where you go, when you go, how long you're gone, and it does all of it in real time. Now, do I like technology? I do. Do I like this technology? I do not. Teachers will be able to monitor student movement on a live dashboard. The system can flag when students have overlapping passes. It can limit how many kids are in the hallway at any given time, and it can even restrict bathroom access based on the schedule. Do you know who I think or how that should be done? Teachers should do that. But should you have a digital tracking system for kids to go to the off to the restroom? I don't think so. I think this is a waste of time and money, and I think it's very, very intrusive. Anyway, glad to have you with me on a First Amendment Friday. You know, there's a brand new study out that puts the cost of raising a child to age 18 at a record high in America, and that's before you even decide whether or not to send your kids off to college. So I thought we'd talk to Bill Dendy, who's a financial advisor serving as a registered principal with Raymond James. Bill, welcome to the program. I take it you've got something to say about the cost of raising kids in America.
Oh, my gosh. Had they told me ahead of time what it was going to cost to raise these kids, we might have paid more attention to health class or something. I don't know. But it's expensive, and as you point out, $300,000 is the current projection from birth to age 18. And if you go to college, it's even more. And this projection is based on the average American family earning about $100,000 a year. It's quite a bit more if you do more for the kids or if you live in a higher income area where rents are higher. But $300,000 is such a big number. And if you have two or three kids, no wonder some families are having a greater challenge planning for retirement and everything else when the children are a real cost. And they're really not great investments. I mean, try to sell them later, you don't get $300,000 back out of them. So I don't know.
Well, and in fact, Bill, when you talk about them as a good investment, even if you're not trying to sell them, I realize you're joking, but we don't even live in a society where mom and dad raise the kids with the plan that they are part of the retirement plan for mom and dad or grandma and grandpa, do we?
No, it's kind of an interesting situation that we're hopeful that our kids will at least be merciful in our selection of nursing homes. But we don't expect them to take care of us the rest of our lives like maybe we did a generation or two ago, or the way it is in other cultures. And so for a lot of families, our goal is to get the kids up and raised, and we hope not to be a burden on our children, knowing that if we become a burden to our children, they may not be able to shoulder the burden themselves with their cost of raising their kids and their cost of getting things launched and paying for their own retirements.
Okay, so what's the best way to cut those costs, Bill? What's the best way for an average American family to be able to afford this price tag of $303,000 for the cost of raising kids to 18, a child to 18 in the year 2026?
Well, I think the first thing is to be aware that it is a serious cost, and it's at times like this that we should go out and recognize the resources that are available to us. A lot of people leave money on the table. They have programs at work. They have the ability to save pre-tax dollars to pay for childcare. They have the ability to get some benefits and credits that they may not be aware of on the front end. So it's worth the time to get the education to take advantage of the free money that's out there, and then to plan, because I see a lot of dual income earners realize as they have their second or their third child that the cost of daycare can suddenly wipe out an entire salary. And so it becomes one of those questions on do we space things out, or do we take advantage of perhaps co-op daycares or other things that may be available to us along the way? So get the free money and do some planning. Consolidate debt. If you're not comfortable doing all these things, it's worth the time with a certified financial planner or a CPA that's familiar in these areas. And for a lot of parents, they want to also cover the college education expenses. And that's another area where I see people leaving money on the table by not getting started ahead of time, not knowing what college they want to encourage their children to attend. It's not always, not every degree is created equal. It's not always getting into the best school you can get into, but to the best school that we can afford that has perhaps a payout into the future and has the availability to have some of that cost covered if we don't have that wealth in the family and if we don't have the ability to get academic scholarships. There are other ways to fund the college education.
You know what I'd like to see, Bill? I've seen lists from time to time from different organizations that actually say, if you go to this college, the average graduate sees the average wages they will earn go up by this or this or this. And some of them are really sad. I mean, they say you go to this college and the average graduate makes $2 an hour more than they would have with just a high school diploma. And you think $2 for a year is $4,000. You know, if you're going to increase your earnings by, you know, $4,000 a year, but you're spending $100,000 on the, on the cost of the education, that doesn't even pay the interest costs of putting a kid in that college. And I think you could start by just saying, don't pursue any degree that ends in the word studies. Have you ever given that advice to a client?
Well, I have given the advice that not every degree is equal. And yes, medieval literature studies does not usually pay as much as nuclear engineering or something. So I do think that that's important on the front end. And young people at the age of 18, 19, and 20 are making life decisions, and a lot of them are saddling themselves with debt that they will bear for years to come. And a lot of it's easy to get to. We have, it's nice that we can get educated and we can borrow money for educational expenses, yet the federal subsidies our federal loans are not easily forgivable. They're the types of things that will follow you even into your retirement if you still
have. No, and in fact, Bill, I don't want them to be forgivable. I want every kid who goes into college to say, I'm going to borrow money. I'm going to make my skills and talents better. I'm going to go make more money, and then I'm going to pay the money back. That is Bill Demde from Raymond James, trying to get you your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Your shoulders hurt.
If you're surrounded by Northwest liberals,
I cannot stand these morons any longer. If you don't come with me this instant, I shall run amok.
Come to the place where common sense prevails, the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. As I mentioned at the top of the show, the Democrats in the Commonwealth of Virginia, they think they just handed themselves a 10-to-1 congressional advantage in a state that is ordinarily split about 50-50 Democrat and Republican, but they've redrawn the map in a way that would give 10 of the 11 seats to the Democrats, only one to the Republicans, and except that's now been thrown out by a judge who's declared that the vote itself was illegal and unconstitutional. So I thought we'd talk about it with Joe Lupino Esposito, who's federal policy director at the Pacific Legal Foundation. Joe, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
How do we solve this problem? Because, I mean, even the founders who said that you're going to have to make sure that apportionment is done so that every member of Congress represents roughly the same number of Americans. I think it's around 800,000 per member of Congress. So as states gain or lose population, they've got to redraw the maps. But they knew that process was going to be inherently political. How do we make it political but still fair? Because what just happened in Commonwealth, Virginia doesn't sound fair at all.
Right. And, you know, there's a lot of issues with what happened in Virginia in particular. You know, you have some states where it's kind of straightforward of how they can change these laws. Texas is one of those, right? They kind of just went in there and they changed it up. That's what their law permitted. But in Virginia, it was a little trickier because they actually had done a constitutional amendment back in 2021 saying we want to have a bipartisan commission that puts these things together. We don't want to have it be subject to the regular political process. And look, there's plenty of criticism to go around for those commissions. You know, they've been challenged before in court if they're constitutional or not. But, you know, they've survived over the years. So this was sort of an issue that was championed by Democrats for many years. When they came in the majority, they weren't as enthused about it. But to their credit and the Republicans' credit, they passed this thing, and they did the new districts in 2021. This time around, they've said, look, we think there's some fundamental unfairness going on in other states. In other words, talking about North Carolina and Texas doing redistricting. And therefore, to be more fair, we are going to go back to the typical political gerrymandering process. And perhaps the biggest joke of all is that they're saying it's only temporary. We're just going to fix it up once we come back to 2030.
Well, so, but how do they justify a result that says we are going to end up with Democrats holding 10 of the 11 seats in a state that's pretty close to 50-50 Democrat and Republican, right?
Yes, and you know, and that's just kind of the nature of when you do these gerrymanders. Usually, particularly when you have a bipartisan commission, you won't have those problems, right? They're going to try to aim to hit the overall goals or the overall numbers of the state. They're going to try to be reasonable as to which districts make the most sense being put together. You know, in the last time around, they did a lot of linking people by county as best they could. It couldn't be perfect, obviously, in some areas, but you know, if there's a few rural counties altogether, that makes the most sense. These districts, you have them basically all coming out of Arlington and Alexandria. So you're having these two areas, you know, the former parts of Washington, D.C., are now going to have, I think, 6 or 7 representatives just for those municipalities, which is kind of wild and really one of the more extreme ones that we've seen, even in California and other left-leaning states as well. This is kind of beyond any of those.
But Joe, why would they view it as unfair? I mean, I understand. I live in a state. I'm in Washington State. They have a commission. It's 2 Democrats. It's 2 Republicans. Each side suggests their redrawing of the lines. They come to some agreement and then hand it to the state legislature and say, okay, put your stamp of approval on it. And it's more or less fair right down the middle because you have 2 Republicans and 2 Democrats, and you get something that is a little bit like Goldilocks, not too hot, not too cold, just right in the middle. What's the objection to doing it that way?
Right. I mean, that's always the ideal, right? Like any good negotiation, everybody goes home a little bit upset, right? Like that's how this ought to go in an ideal world. Here, really, their whole basis on how they talked about fairness, and, you know, it's not in the statute per se, but everything around it, the advertising from the PACs, and even, frankly, the statements from the legislators were saying, look, we think this is unfair because of what other states are doing by doing these mid-cycle changes, so we're going to force ourselves to get involved in this. And really, sort of the joke of it is calling it this, putting it in this fairness language, and never mind how ridiculous the wording was on the actual referendum. But if it's so fair and so wonderful, why is it only temporary? You know, if this is really the way we should be doing things, why would we go back to evidently the unfair system that we had in place just for the last handful of years?
I guess I just wish there were some ideal way to do this that produced something that both sides, like you said, would be a little bit unhappy with, but in general would say, yeah, that's pretty fair. And start with first, you know, geographic boundaries, county boundaries, things like that, and say, try to make districts that are somewhat contiguous, because otherwise you get real joke districts. I mean, you know, I've seen districts that hop a mountain range. I've seen districts that cut a town in half. I've seen districts that, you know, extend out like an octopus or a squid, you know, and they don't make any sense. And everybody agrees, you're right. That's a stupid way to do it, but it benefits my side. So therefore, that's what we're going to do.
Right. And, you know, and it creates this very high stakes environment in these state elections every 10 years, or at least that's always how it had been. It was once every 10 years when these things were redone. You know, now it kind of changes the game when states are doing this midterm. So it's lower stakes then, I guess, at that time of the census, if we're going to allow this and not have the commissions. But in a sense, it's going to have a little bit more volatility. It's going to be harder for people to understand who their representatives are in Congress. So really, I mean, if you had states, you know, even if they were doing it on a partisan basis, if they just kind of came to the table with some sort of first principles, or even, you know, a constitutional amendment that says, hey, look, we're going to generally respect these ideas, and then they can fight on the margins. But, you know, that's an ideal world, and, you know, the laws, men aren't angels, you know the line, right? So this is kind of what we run into every time.
No, and what I'd really like, I'd like to see them have a system that doesn't count illegal aliens, people who are in the country illegally, who have no right to be here, have no right to vote, who have no right to run for office, and say, but we still have members of Congress. My understanding is, in the numbers, California would lose 6 members of Congress if you didn't count all the people who are living illegally in that state.
No, that's correct, and that is one of the things that can change with the census itself, is how do you actually do that count? You know, if it should just be citizens, that's going to reduce it in a number of areas, because right now they're just doing whoever is living in that area with no regard to citizenship. And it doesn't make sense. We're talking about voting rights and the ability to vote in the election. You think you want to talk about the people who are represented, not just anyone else who happens to be there.
That's absolutely right. Joe Lupino Esposito from the Pacific Legal Foundation. Joe, thanks very much.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. FM News 101.
You ready for the big show? In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. If bail is to ensure that criminal defendants go to court and answer the charges against them, does eliminating private bail bonds make the system better? Does it make it more fair? Does it make it, does it reduce accountability is a real bottom line question. I thought I'd pose that question because right now public defenders, the defense attorneys who get paid to put criminals back on the streets in both King and Snohomish counties, they are pushing the Washington State Supreme Court to consider changes to Washington State's bail bonds requirement. They say it's going to be more equitable. I think I might get a different view from Courtney Weimer, who is with All City Bail Bonds in Tacoma. She's also the head of an organization that represents the bail bonds industry. Courtney, welcome back to the program.
Hi there, Lars.
What should the average person think of this proposal to say, if you're in for a misdemeanor, you have to give $20 to the court and then you can walk out the door? Or am I oversimplifying it by putting it that way?
No, that's exactly correct. And I think the average citizen should just realize is another absurd proposal in Washington State. It completely takes away accountability and basically reduces bail by 90%.
Now, I understand you're going to speak out in favor of your industry, and I have no problem with your industry. I actually think it makes a lot of sense. A court says, say, Lars, you've been arrested for X. I've never been arrested in my life, but your bail is $20,000. And I said, well, how am I going to get out? So I call up Courtney. I've never had reason to call a bail bonds, but if I did, I call Courtney up. Say, Courtney, how much do I have to pay for you to post $20,000 bail? And you say, well, it's going to cost you this much. I don't know what the fee is. And you have to show up for court. And if you don't show up for court, we're going to chase you down because it's in our best interest to get you in front of the court. Otherwise, All City Bail Bonds owes $20,000 to the courts. That's how it works, isn't it?
Well, that is correct. And to add a key piece to that is that your friends and family are the ones that are signing for you. So, you know, if little Johnny gets a court case and he realizes that, hey, mom and grandma are on the hook for this, it's going to want to make him a lot more responsible to come back to court. Whereas if anybody with an ID can just walk in and pay 10% with no accountability for the other 90, and it just completely defeats the purpose. So I think the key part of bail is that your friends and family are the ones that are on the hook for this, not only above the bail bond company. And yeah, we have a vested interest in returning somebody to make sure that they complete their court case.
What's your track record like, Courtney?
Pretty dang good. there's nationwide studies that the rate of defendants completing their court case when out on bond is much higher and then out on a PR.
Do you think that the real agenda here isn't so much the immediate release of the criminal pending trial or pending the rest of the judicial process, but really it's simply saying we want to make it more likely that criminals are going to see no consequence at all because they just don't have to show up for court? What's the real agenda of these public defenders?
Well, I don't think that they would tell you that, but that seems to be the track record in Washington State. It's just gotten more and more lenient as the years have gone on. And these judges already take into account somebody's financial situation when they're making these determinations. So if somebody is in jail, it's not because of money. It's because either they've got warrant history, criminal history, are a danger to the community, or they're going to interfere with the administration of justice. Because if it was just your average citizen that didn't have money, judges would already consider that and let you go regardless.
There's another element to this, Courtney, and it's a little bit outside your lane, but I want you to comment on it. I can't remember the last time I did stories on this. They said every time a person is picked up on a warrant because they didn't show for court, so the judge issued a bench warrant and said, arrest this person. They get arrested, they get booked through jail, and then usually processed out, often in hours, sometimes in a day or two. But they're back out on the streets with this kind of situation, that every one of those trips through the system back in the day was $300. Maybe now it's a lot more. But people forget there is a cost to the police picking you up, writing the reports, taking you downtown, running you through the booking process if you haven't been already. And they said they had no-show bail arrests that, where people would go through the system 20 times, and every trip was $300. It's incredibly expensive to the rest of the system. Whereas saying you've got a bond, your mom signed for it, you don't show, her house goes away. And as you said, people tend to pay attention to that. If you say, give us $20 and you can walk out the door, then I think they're free to say, well, I don't take that very seriously then, because they only ask me for $20. I'm just not going to show up. And one of these days, the cops will pick me up. I'll run through the process and they'll probably just cut me loose again. You think I'm on the right track?
I think you're absolutely on the right track. With them wanting to cap gross misdemeanors, and warrants at $200 in most cases, it denies a judge's ability to look at their criminal history, their warrant history. So, yeah, it would just be another revolving door. And you're talking about an already understaffed police department and jail. You know, they're working doubles most of the time. They don't have the staffing or the funding to be able to do things like this. Police departments rarely go after warrants as it is.
And sadly, they could. I mean, if they went out and say, did in fare enforcement on public transit or just regular traffic stops, they tend to find a lot of people out on warrants. I'm talking to Courtney Weimer, who's at All City Bail Bonds in Tacoma. Now, even though this proposal, I agree with you, is preposterous coming from the defense attorneys who make more money when their clients take more trips through the system, how likely is it that the Washington Supreme Court is going to simply say, sure, why not?
Well, you know, I hope not. The makeup of the Supreme Court right now is interesting. I haven't looked yet today, but yesterday I think there was 106 comments and 95 of those were against the proposal and 11 were for it. So if that gives you any idea about the public feeling on this, and I encourage everybody, you have until April 30th to submit your comments to supreme.courts.wa.gov. And I think everyone needs to let their voice be heard on this matter.
Yeah. Although, I got to tell you, Courtney, the number of times in both Oregon and Washington that you have 200,000 comments from people and 95% of them are against something, and then the folks in Olympia and Salem tend to look at that and say, yeah, let's do exactly the opposite of what the public is asking us to do. They seem to get some kind of perverse joy out of doing that kind of thing, but maybe at some point we'll wake them up. Thank you so much, Courtney. I appreciate the time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Mark.
You bet. That's Courtney Weimer. She's at All City Bail Bonds in Tacoma. As I said, I have no financial interest in bail bonds. I've never had the need of bail bonds. I hope that I never will have the need of a bail bond. But imagine that. You get picked up for committing a crime against somebody. It's a misdemeanor crime. And the judge is told, if they go for this idea, $200 bail, the person must post a $20 sawbuck to just walk out the door. That's nuts. You got the Lars Larson Show.
This is Dr.
Taxes. What say you, Robin Hood?
So you think you're overtaxed, overworked, and paid off with a knife, a club, or a rope?
Why, you speak treason.
Fluently.
This is the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I have to point this out. This is true of so many different places in America that are operated by the Democrat Party, and you can pick any one of the 22 states that are the deep blue states where they've elected Democrats as governors, to their state legislature and everything else. And then they say, we have solutions to these problems. And one of the most pernicious problems has been homelessness. Well, Denver, Colorado has poured time and money and progressive policies into this problem, and the problem is getting even bigger. I suspect that somebody should clue them in that the homeless have decided, if they build it, we will come. And I think that Teller County Sheriff Jason Mikesell knows that. He's a Republican candidate for Colorado governor. Sheriff Mikesell, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much for having me on today.
Now, if I got any of that wrong, feel free to correct me, but I've felt that a lot of the blue states are simply making the problem worse with their alleged solutions.
No, they're falling apart, and that's the same problem we're seeing in Denver, Colorado downtown.
Tell me about the situation at 16th Street in downtown Denver, because I haven't been there in a while.
You know, I grew up in Colorado, and look, you can't even go downtown anymore from fear of muggings and just the amount of homeless everywhere. The thing is, you have 30% of the businesses have shut down, and you have 30% vacancy all throughout the downtown, which has never happened. You used to be able to go down and get a ball game, get a beer, and maybe get a hamburger, but that you just can't do anymore. You have to hurry from a car to the stadium and get out of there as soon as possible. And you know, the biggest issue that they're doing right now is, to hide it, they're actually shipping out homeless, and they're shipping them. They're shipping them down to Bent County, Colorado, to an old military base that used to be a hospital, and they're housing them there. And it's destroying that small town also. And it's all in a way just to cover up the lie that they're saying that they're decreasing their homeless population throughout Colorado.
I mean, Sheriff Mikesell, this reminds me, and tell me if you would agree with this, there are communist countries like China that when they have an Olympics or a big event coming up, they say, gather up all the homeless people, gather up the down and out, and put them somewhere for a while just for appearance's sake. It's kind of like the reverse of a Potemkin village. They say, just clean this up so it doesn't look like we have a problem, and then the problem comes right back. Except in this case, in your case, they're shipping them down to this military base, but does that actually fix the problem, and does it make it any better?
Yeah, it doesn't help anything. And here's the biggest problem. These people are actually, they have a lot of behavioral health issues. It's a lot of mental health issues. And it's all based from drug use and Colorado giving drugs to criminals. Look, even in my jail now, we have programs where when they leave the jails, all our Colorado taxpayer dollars are being used to give them the drugs they need when they get out to keep them in their habit. And that way, they can just deal with the constant crime issues. It's ridiculous what they're doing.
Well, how do they expect this to fix the problem? And how do they justify giving, are these illegal drugs? Or are we talking about giving heroin addicts methadone or something like that?
That's exactly what you're talking about. Giving them medications they should not have. Here's the bigger side of it. Look, we're $1.4 billion in debt in the state because of these types of programs. This lack of leadership, this misunderstanding, misguided effort on how we deal with people that truly need to be in a critical care facility, somewhere that can get them out of using this stuff and get them off the streets, get them back to normal lives, get them the real medications that they need, or let's just try to get them in a program to help them, get them back on their feet. But instead, we're just band-aiding the problem because it's cheaper, it's faster, it's easier, and we can blame it on Republicans.
Okay, so Sheriff Mikesell, tell my audience where they can find you on social media, but then tell me, what would you do differently as governor of Colorado should you win election?
Yep. Well, you can find me at Mikesell, the number 4gov.com. You can just Google my name, Mikesell, 4gov. And then here's the thing I would do. I would immediately look at bringing back in sanatoriums and health treatment programs. We've got to get them off the streets. You just can't band-aid this problem anymore. The other side, I would allow law enforcement to be unhandcuffed in the state. And let's take our streets back and not have the crime that's happening. Those are the things you could do immediately to make an impact in Colorado.
You know, Sheriff, a long time ago, I talked to judges. I was a reporter for a long time. And they would say, yeah, I oversee drug court. And they described the idea to me. I'm guessing this was 30 years ago. And I said, well, how's that work? And they said, we bring in all these people who are arrested, usually for what are now viewed as minor crimes, DCS or PCS, possession of a controlled substance, or even small amounts of distribution. And we give them a choice. You can have a felony conviction. You might spend some time in jail, but you're going to get that mark on your record. Or you can go into the treatment program. And if you stick with it for a year, then we will wipe out the felony conviction. There'll still be something on your record, but it won't be a felony conviction. And they said that got like 95% of the drug addicts and even the ones involved in distribution to say, okay, I'll voluntarily go into treatment. Are you still able to do that in the state of Colorado?
No, right? Because it's,
wow.
The issue in Colorado is we want to misidentify it as everyone else's fault. They have to take personal accountability, and you have to hold them to personal accountability. And that's the only way you deal with those things. And sometimes you have to be tough on folks to make them understand how to get clean. And a lot of them want to get sober. They want to get dried out. But they don't have an opportunity when you have a state of Colorado that's actually putting them under medications.
Well, at least, I mean, I could say this about the idea of shipping off to the military base. Are they at least controlling it so that you don't have a population of addicts who are then able to be served by a population of dealers who show up at the venue?
That's what's happening. So it's an old military base, and it was given to the state of Colorado for $1 a year. It's actually an old training ground for medicine for the military. They gave it to Colorado. Colorado was using it for Department of Corrections, and then they transferred it to this use where they've got homeless. But the homeless leave there. They go down to a small town of about 500 people. They invade the town, and now they have higher fentanyl problems, higher drug problems than they ever had. You can't have a vehicle not getting broken into. And it's just this horrible disadvantage for people with homes because their home values are dropping like crazy. That's what's happening.
Well, you've got to win as governor. And if you got that, do you have a legislature that will actually go along with you? Because a lot of people assume the governor can do anything, but the governor still needs a legislature that will actually pass the laws necessary to give you the authority to do what you have to do.
Well, the nice thing about being a CEO and a sheriff, I understand how to get around some of that and deal with things. And sometimes that's the direction you got to go. You just can't be a legislature and think you're going to win. But thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
No, I'm glad to do it. Remind my audience again where they can find your social media so they can read about your positions on the other issues.
So it's Mikesell, the number 4gov. You can find me online on any of our social media. Donations would be appreciated. And your time and your investment in my campaign being really helpful. Thank you,
Jason,
so very much.
Jason, it's a pleasure to have you on. I hope that someday I'm calling you Governor Jason Mikesell. Sheriff, it is a pleasure to have you on the program.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
Portland's news, traffic, and weather. Dropping a Portland truth bomb.
My favorite thing about living in Portland is no matter how many fentanyl overdoses happen, no matter how many tents get set up, you can't blame black people for that.
Back to Lars. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I hope you won't think me less Christian than I am. But the fact is, I'm celebrating because the world's most prolific serial killer has died behind bars today. And when I saw that news, I thought, I don't often celebrate when somebody passes away. But when it comes to the worst serial killer, the most prolific single killer of women and babies in the world. And I think I can say that. I think there was and has been nobody more prolific than Kermit Gosnell. I think that is worth celebrating. Ann McElhaney joins me now because Ann knows this story very, very well. She and her significant other, Phelan McAleer, are founders of the Unreported Stories Society and the authors, most notably, of Gosnell, The Trial of America's Biggest Serial Killer. Ann, welcome back to the program. It's been a while since we've talked, but I think this was an appropriate end for Kermit Gosnell, was it not?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I think it's extraordinary news. I think there'll be a lot of people celebrating. I'm getting all kinds of messages from all kinds of people today. And we just talked to Detective Jim Wood, who obviously put him behind bars and who's, you know, who's very happy that, you know, he won't kill anyone else. You know, that possibility is gone forever, which is something marvelous. And just thinking about what he did, you know, maybe your listeners remember Kermit Gosnell, who ran this, you know, abortion clinic, inverted commas, by the way, in West Philadelphia, which was a charnel house where he basically drugged these women up. They delivered babies that were alive, and then he cut their necks with scissors. And according to the grand jury, he probably did that to thousands of babies. He only went to prison for 3 counts of murder and obviously got 3 life sentences. But it was a lot more than that. And it's just an extraordinary, I kind of had forgotten about him, and then to find this out is amazing.
Well, I think it's amazing too, Anne, because I can't count the number of times that you and Fela McAleer and I have talked about this guy. And one of the biggest, I guess, enduring mysteries for me is that that to a large extent, if you mentioned Ted Bundy to somebody, or if you mentioned Ted Kaczynski to someone, if you mentioned any one of the lesser serial killers of the last 30 or 40 or 50 years, people would say, "Oh, I know who that is." And then you say, yes. Kermit Gosnell. Is there a reason that Americans simply, for the most part, don't know this guy's name at all?
Yeah, and the reason is that the mainstream media chose and admitted it, by the way. They admitted, we have a whole chapter in our book about it, they admitted that they didn't want to give any kind of attention to this guy because they didn't want anything negative said about abortion. I mean, famously, the Washington Post's Sarah Cliff was challenged by Molly Hemingway, you know, because Molly Hemingway was writing on Twitter and back in the day and saying, "Why aren't you writing about this?" And famously, Sarah Cliff said, "Oh, we don't do local stories." Well, that's funny because I thought Trayvon Martin was a local story. I thought George Floyd was a local story. I mean, you know, we're local story. They love local stories. They adore local stories. And in fact, days after that exchange on Twitter, the editor of the Washington Post had to come out and apologize and say, we do actually cover local, you know, and this is an incredibly important story. And it's important for so many reasons, you know, not least of which, by the way, the fact that the Department of Health in Pennsylvania, who really should have gone to prison themselves, let's be really honest about it, for 17 years, they didn't inspect the clinic. Two women died. Shamika Shaw died in 2000. And in 2009, Karnamaya Monger died, a Bhutanese refugee. I mean, this is who the left are supposed to love, right? This yep. Bhutanese refugee, she's in America for 4 months, by the way. Like, you know, finally she got to the promised land after being in a refugee camp for 20 years. Finally she arrives, only to die from being drugged to death by untrained staff that Gosnell had working for them. And I always think about her, by the way. And when you think about how demonic Kermit Gosnell was, the scene of her dying, she didn't speak English. You can imagine how terrified she was. She ends up in this clinic. It's dirty. It's filthy. He's not even there. And she starts to think, I'm in trouble. You know the way you'd get a sense in yourself? You'd think,
yep.
God, I'm in serious trouble right now. So she starts to get really agitated. They phone Gosnell and say, she's getting very agitated. And he said famously, drug her up.
Wow.
And they did, and she died. And I just think it was just, it's a terrible, terrible story. And the Department of Health in Pennsylvania, you know, I mean, really should have actually had to answer in a court of law for what they did, for the criminal neglect that they showed to the people who ended up in that place. 17 years. They didn't cross the threshold. They didn't care that Shamika Shaw died. She was in her early 20s, an African-American mother. They didn't care. They didn't care about Karnamaya Monger. They didn't care. There was one doctor, by the way, who complained that his patients were coming back after being to the clinic and they had STDs that they had gotten from being in the clinic, which was so dirty and disgusting. And they were reusing instruments, and that's how these people got these STDs. And he went and he actually, and I remember his testimony in the grand jury, he hand-delivered a complaint. He hand-delivered it to the Department of Health. And still, they did nothing. So these are despicable people, but the most despicable of all is the man who was perpetrating these evil crimes.
And that's Kermit Gosnell. And by the way, for people to say, well, but you have a different position on abortion. You can have whatever position you want on abortion. I happen to be pro-life. But if you've said the minute it involves abortion, even if it involves the kind of criminal activity toward women that Kermit Gosnell did to women, and say, well, but because it somehow involved abortion, nobody is allowed to say anything negative about what happened or what Gosnell did because he did abortions. He murdered babies, and that was what the grand jury found. He took little babies and took a pair of surgical shears and cut their spinal cords. That's what they decided. Well, he has now passed away. The people who I think did the best job in documenting all of Kermit Gosnell's thousands of crimes, Anne McElhaney, Anne, thank you very much, and Fela McAleer, founders of the Unreported Stories Society and the authors of Gosnell, The Trial of America's Biggest Serial Killer. I'd ask you to do this test. When you watch the mainstream media over the next couple of days, you would think if there were a serial killer in America who had just died behind bars after committing thousands of murders, would you expect that that would merit some kind of mention on national news? And then ask yourself this, a day or two or three from now, ask yourself if you've heard ABC, NBC, CBS, PBS, MSNBC, or MSDNC. Have you heard any of them even mention Kermit Gosnell? And if they don't, then you have to ask yourself this. Are they capable of simply keeping the secret of the worst serial killer on planet Earth simply because he did his serial killing from an abortion clinic that was a clinic of horrors that Philadelphia didn't even bother to look at for 17 years? Back in a moment. I'm glad to get your phone calls and emails. You're listening.
Jeff Jr., founder.
Have something to say? Give Lars a call at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's my favorite day of the week, First Amendment Friday. All phone calls are welcome. All subjects are fair game. And as always, naysayers go to the head of the line. Before we get to any of your calls, though, and emails, I want to talk to Kevin Starrett. He is the lone guy who is holding down the line on the Second Amendment in the state of Oregon. And it's become a very, very tough job because the Democrats in Salem have effectively said, we don't care what the public says. We're going to go ahead and do whatever it is that we want to do. The latest example, of course, a measure which is being touted by the legacy media is, oh, this is delaying Measure 114. And if you say, well, what's Measure 114? Isn't that the one they found unconstitutional after the voters approved it almost 3 years ago? And the answer is, yeah, that's the one that's still unconstitutional until and unless the Oregon Supreme Court decides it is constitutional. Kevin, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Lars.
So this thing is going to get pushed forward, it sounds like, come hell or high water, on party lines to pass a ballot measure to make Measure 114 even worse?
Yeah, it takes Measure 114 and it makes it worse. It basically jacks up the fees. It indemnifies the police if they don't do their job. And of course, if you want to challenge it in court, you go to their court, because you see, if you live in Union County or any other county except Marion County, you're a serf and you do not get to go to your own county judge. You have to come to Marion County. So the deck is totally stacked as usual.
Now, what do they think that people are going to do? Because they've had the lesson that last fall, when the Democrats said, we're going to gigantically jack up taxes, and the people said, no, you're not. And they very quickly gathered more than 250,000 signatures. I mean, it used to be that I kind of assumed Oregonians would, to some extent, just roll over and say, well, that's what the legislature did. They're not listening to us, but that's what they did, so we're not going to challenge it. But I think the public may have a new appetite for actually saying, no, you're not, and knock the legislature back into its place. Is that possible?
Well, I think it's very unlikely. I mean, obviously, what we saw with the tax bill was people are unified in not having their wallets reduced all the time. But Oregonians do not have a good track record when they go to the polls to take away people's gun rights. So it's theoretically possible, but I certainly don't want to see this stuff decided by ballot measure. What I want to see is Republican legislators stand up for the people who hired them, which they have the power to do to put a stop to this stuff. And so far, we're seeing very little of that.
I guess the only thing, and Kevin, I don't just push back to be a contrarian, but look at it. Ballot measure 114 passed by what was a bare 10,000 votes out of more than a million votes cast. It wasn't like it was a gigantic landslide of support for a new gun law.
Right. Well, that's true. And I'm not convinced it passed at all, because remember that crook Fagan said it passed before all the votes had been counted.
Yep.
But the ballot measure, as you know, ballot measures in Oregon are completely controlled by the Democrats. Every single aspect of it, from the ballot title to who gets to create the ballot title to who gets to count the votes. And it's a very, very messy situation. And if every single time what we saw Ed Deal had to do was spend a lot of money and a lot of capital to fight something that the Democrats got for free. And the Democrats can continue to do this for free and force the Republicans into these constant, unending, expensive battles, which the Democrats can then go in reverse again. And I really don't see that this is the best way to handle it when a lot of people have hired Republicans to go there and stand up for them. And at this point, they just refuse to do it. You know, we can have a ballot measure every time there's a law we don't like, but that's a really messy way to legislate.
Yeah, it is. And it's not much of a check because the legislature tends to look at the vote of the people and say, yeah, we're going to do that anyway. I could give you a half a dozen examples where they saw the people vote yes and the legislature said no, or vice versa, that they don't at all pay attention. There's one thing I want you to do for me, if you would, because I can't tell you how many people I've had come to me and say, Lars, Measure 114 is not an outright ban on buying guns. And I said, yes, it is. I want you to make the case and make it in terms so simple that everybody can explain to their, you know, their friends, say, this is a ban on buying guns. Because a lot of people just don't believe it. Oh, it's a permit, it's fees, it's this, it's that. What is it, Kevin?
Here's the explanation. The legislature demands that you pay a high fee and jump through hoops to exercise a right given to you by God, but they refuse to give you the hoops. That's the explanation.
That's a great explanation because they say, well, you just have to get a permit. Yeah, but how do I get a permit? Well, first you take a class. Oh, who offers the class? Maybe nobody. I mean, there's nothing in the law that says the police agencies who have to approve the class you have to take are going to offer that class or approve anybody else to teach it, right?
Right, and there's no cap on the fee if you find someone to teach it. It has to be somebody who can provide you with a firearm, which is not always going to happen. And there's no cap on the fees, which they just more than doubled every time they want to renew this thing. The reality is look, if we make it a permit only to exercise a right, it is no longer a right. It is a privilege that is doled out to you by who's ever in power, which can be taken away at any time. It's that simple, and how any court can find this constitutional is absolutely astonishing to me. And there is no limit to what these people can do, and yet this will be a permit that is available to very few rich people, and the disenfranchised communities that the Democrats always claim to protect have gotten screwed once again.
I mean, the minute you jack up the fee to $150 from $65, you've just locked a whole bunch of people out. Because, Kevin, the way I add up the numbers, I have a good salary. There are a lot of people who listen to this show who have a healthy salary. But if you say, well, I want to get a gun for protection, say, okay, $150 for the application, then you're going to have to take the class. Who knows what that's going to cost? Might be a couple of $100. Okay, add that on. A simple, not even a fancy pistol of some kind, $300 to $500. You can spend a lot more, but you might get it for $300 to $500. And then you're going to have to go out and buy ammunition, go to a range, practice, do all those things. Well, hold on. You're talking about close to $1,000. Yeah. Average folks may not be able to afford that, correct?
Lars, if the fee was 50 cents, it would be unacceptable.
I agree.
This is a right. End of story. And at some point, someone's going to have to stand up down in Salem and tell these people to stop.
Well, sadly, it sounds like the legislature is going to pass making a law even worse that the Oregon Supreme Court has not even decided is constitutional. And if you read the Oregon Constitution, Section 27, you realize it's not. It's First Amendment Friday. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Your emails are welcome. talk@LarsLarson.com. And check out my Instagram feed where you'll find I've got a face for radio.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. FM News 101.
If it's over, in exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come. to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Mars.
And
Mars.
Now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I got to tell you something. There are times that people tell me that Donald Trump, and they know I support Donald Trump, voted for him all three times. I mean, if I'd been a Democrat, I might have voted for him six or eight times. But since I'm a conservative, I only voted for him three times. And he was elected, I figure, three times, even though President Otto Penn occupied the office for 4 years and did a lot of damage to America. But there are times that I find some of what Donald Trump does is a bit inconsistent because, one, we've got to get the illegal aliens out of our country. Two, we understand that some of the illegal aliens, a tiny, tiny fraction of all the illegals in America, actually do some farm work in America. And I know there's going to be a time of adjustment because American agriculture is going to have to get by without slaves. And as far as I'm concerned, illegal aliens are nothing but a modern day version of the slaves that were in America until the Civil War and until Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. And why is that? Because the Democrats need to have a category of slaves, and they've decided we're going to have them do this work. Now, I've been told for decades why they're doing the work that Americans won't do. You mean with the best estimates that even before Joe Biden's open borders policy, that we had 22 to 30 million illegal aliens, and the number of farm jobs that might have been done by illegal aliens was just a shade under 1 million, that somehow 1 million out of 30 million justifies the presence of the rest? But now President Trump is trying to make it cheaper and easier for farmers to hire temporary foreign farm workers through the H-2A visa program, cutting the minimum wage for foreign workers. And I wanted to talk about that with Dylan Honkoop. Dylan joins me now, who's with the Whatcom County Farmers, Family Farmers, and Save Family Farming. Hey, Dylan, welcome back to the program. What's on your mind?
Thanks for having me, Lars. And I would say cheaper and easier. I mean, that's like saying Starlink and Elon Musk has made it cheaper and easier to put satellites in space. Maybe they have, but there is still nothing cheap or easy about it. And that's, I think, what the progressive activists who have been lobbying against this last resort that farms have been relying on to provide labor, they are finally finding some success in convincing people of this lie that somehow farmers are getting a free pass here to underpay people via the Trump administration, which couldn't be further from the truth.
Well, in fact, when they tell the farmers that the minimum wage for, say, H-2A visa workers, so these are ones coming in legally, but they're coming in under a visa program, and that you used to have to pay them close to $20 an hour, and now that rate is going to be cut to $15 an hour. Dylan, at some point, doesn't America have to wean itself off of some of the foreign labor work that was done for decades by illegal aliens and say, maybe we should go to automation of those jobs, and maybe we should pay the kinds of wages that will attract American workers to those jobs? Is that an illegitimate kind of way of going after this?
I think it's already happening, Lars. And you're a capitalist, and
yep.
The capitalist system that we live and operate and do business in is already driving that as hard as possible right now. You know, any area of agriculture that I'm aware of right now is finding anything that they can possibly automate. A lot of the dairies in the region where I grew up now have robotic milkers. They cost a lot of money, but they pencil out now in this era of high labor costs. So it's happening as much and as quickly as possible, but to deny that there is a huge need for work is crazy. We are short on workers, and it is very true. A lot of Americans don't want to do this work. So how are we going to solve this problem? It's a legitimate question to ask. We need to be talking about it, but we certainly can't be glossing over some of the easy talking points that people like to go to, like, oh, people should just do this the legal way, it's incredibly complicated right now. Our immigration system needs an entire overhaul. People from both sides, players on both sides or multiple sides of this situation have put roadblocks in front of actually overhauling the system so it makes sense, so that different American industries, including agriculture and the agriculture community, can get the workers that they need to bring food. I mean, food is kind of important. We all need to eat food. Who's going to be able to do the work? There is a huge shortage right now, and to deny that.
Okay, so Dylan, is the answer
what's happening?
Is the answer some kind of temporary program that only goes for a few years to get the farmers through this transition? At that point, they have to decide, we're going to automate those jobs, we're going to do those jobs through mechanization, or we're going to pay Americans, because Americans do dirty, hard jobs, don't they? I mean, I remember talking to a guy in the nursery industry, you know, the folks who grow landscaping plants and all that, and I said, how many of your workers are illegals? And he said, half. 50% of the worker population is illegal. I said, well, if 50% is illegal, that means the other 50% is legal. Why don't you fill 100% of the jobs with legal workers? Because you can't argue that half my workforce is Americans or people legally here willing to do the work, but I can't find the other people to do the work too. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense, Lars. There's just not enough people to do it. I mean, you try running a farm and trying to staff harvest, try to staff a packing shed right now. I'm not suggesting, oh, you go out and hire illegal immigrants. That's another misnomer that a lot of people don't even know what the immigration status is of someone. Are their documents real or not? Well, hey, there's a big question, too. Am I going to be legally liable if I'm going to be judge and jury as a farmer hiring somebody, if I'm going to decide whether their documents are legit or not?
Dylan, can we do it through E-Verify? So you don't have to determine it. You run these workers through E-Verify. If they come up as solid, you know, legal workers, then you're off the hook. It's then on the folks running the E-Verify system.
Potentially, that's something that will be embraced as part of our immigration system. Are we going to do this or not? But I say to suggest that, well, just hire all legal people is, you know, that's a nice goal. That's what we should be shooting for. But just to say you can snap your fingers and do that is another question. And it's a lot more opaque than a lot of people want to make it sound. So how do we get out of the situation we're in rather than, you know, coming up with an ideal and saying, well, we need to immediately make that happen? We're dealing with a reality of a lot of people here who need food, a lot of people here who it takes to grow this food. You talk about automation. Again, we're trying to do that as quickly as we possibly can and still afford to pay for the technology to do that. I don't know any farmer out there right now who would want to automate more if possible because their labor is so expensive. In some cases, more expensive even than the cost or the price they're getting back for their goods.
I totally agree with you. That is Dylan Honkoop from Save Family Farming. Dylan, thank you very much. Back in just a moment. We'll get to your phone calls and emails, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
This is Mac Daniel.
Disagree with Lars? Great. Naysayers go first at 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. We get in lots of arguments on this program, although I don't think they're very deep, about DEI. That's diversity, equity, and inclusion. We've been talking about it for years. It has never made sense to me. It seems like institutionalized racism to say we're going to pick either the kids who get into a college, the people who get into a job, promotions, and all those things. But we're not going to do it based on skills and abilities. We're going to do it based on your skin color, what's between your legs, and to some extent, what kind of sex you like. That is DEI to me in a nutshell. So the tax dollars that are supposed to be diverted from DEI, well, it turns out that they may not be diverted the way we thought they were going to be. Tim Minella joins me now, Director of Higher Ed at Goldwater Institute. Hey, Tim, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Lars. It's great to be here.
So are these major institutions that get taxpayer money, University of Michigan, for example, getting $250 million on DEI, and then they were told you can't spend the money that way anymore, are they actually complying with those rules?
Well, they chose themselves to spend $250 million on this discriminatory ideology. And they made a very prominent pronouncement last year that said, you know, we've seen the light. We realize that this was a big mistake. By our own metrics, this was a failure. It did not promote inclusion. It did not promote a sense of belonging at all. And we're seeing the light. We're going to get rid of these DEI offices. It
right.
turns out they didn't do anything of the kind. They maintain those offices, and they're still up and running. 84% of the staff of these offices are still at the university. They have not done one single thing to follow through with their promise.
So they just consciously decided, let's conspire to lie about this? I mean, is there any other way to see it?
Well, I think they were responding to the pressure from the Trump administration and really Americans in general who have realized that despite these nice sounding words of diversity, equity, inclusion, as you said, it's really nothing of the sort. It's promoting discrimination and hatred, and we don't want any part of it. And so I think Michigan was responding to that and saying that, you know, we get it. We get it. We made a mistake. We're going to get rid of these offices and positions. But they turned around and they sort of quietly hid these positions. They renamed the names of offices. They renamed the names of job titles to basically hide it from the public that they were still doing DEI and still are doing it to this day.
I mean, because that to me, you know, there's one of my favorite Latin phrases, Tim, is mens rea. It means the guilty mind. So that, you know, if somebody says to me, Lars, I don't like it when you drink alcoholic beverages. And I say, okay, we'll call them adult beverages then. You say, isn't that still booze? Yeah, we're just going to call it by a different name. You know, rheumatiz medicine might be another name. If you want to have bourbon and relabel it. That's the kind of thing that when people do it, you know they're being dishonest. And they must understand that, too. And they take something like the Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at University of Michigan and say it's now the Office of Community, Culture, and Belonging, but it's the same functional operation at the university. They know they're being dishonest, don't they?
That is exactly right. And what I think this reveals that's so important is we need to pass strong policies like Goldwater's abolish DEI bureaucracies policy that makes it very clear that it doesn't matter what you call these things. You want to call it access and belonging because DEI is now a toxic term. That doesn't matter. If you're doing certain things, if you're promoting differential treatment based on race or sex, that's not allowed, and you can't spend any money on it. You can't have any positions devoted to it. And that's the kind of strong policy we need in every state in the country.
Okay, but Tim, I guess maybe, look, I've never been a big fan of lawsuits, but I understand that there is a time where lawsuits make all the difference in the world. I mean, if somebody asks me, have you and Tina filed lawsuits against things? No, we don't. And we've certainly had circumstances where we might have sued a doctor, a lawyer, or somebody else. And we said, no, that's not how we do business. But maybe these colleges need to be sued by both the instructors in them and the students. I have to believe that somewhere there are students who are told, I have to go through this course. I have to take DEI. I'm not going to get admitted to a school because I'm not fitting some criteria that are racist criteria. That when some of those students start suing and then they start hauling some of these professors up and forcing them to testify and to say, hey, did you make decisions about students and about promotion and about things like that based on somebody's skin color or their sexuality or what gender they think they are? And when those professors have to go through that kind of stuff, they might decide, this is not the thing I want to promote.
Well, I agree with you. And I think it points to the need for all levels of government. State governments have strong prohibitions against racial discrimination in their constitutions and their laws. The federal government obviously has the 14th Amendment that prohibits discrimination based on race. These are the kinds of things that we can use to go after the blatant racial discrimination that I agree with you is still happening. You know, they protest these institutions, these universities, and say, you know, we're done with it. We saw the light. That was a 2020 era thing. We see across the country that is not true. It's just gone underground. It's being renamed. It has not disappeared. And we need to keep the pressure on legally and politically.
Yeah, because this nonsense, Tim, I really, you know who I really feel for are the students of color and the students who might somehow benefit from this DEI. Except what happens when you're actually a student at the University of Michigan because you're smart? And then, but everybody around you assumes, oh, it's a person of color. It's a person with a disability of one kind or another. So they probably got in through DEI and not based on the strength of their own work. I would hate to be that young man or woman. That seems incredibly unfair. That's Tim Minella, who's director of the higher education effort at the Goldwater Institute. Tim, thank you very much. I appreciate you coming on the program. Glad to have you with me and always glad to take your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And if you believe in supporting American craftsmanship, U.S. veterans, and independent talk radio, go to my website, LarsLarson.com. Pick up a limited edition Lars Larson Show challenge coin. I'm a collector of challenge coins. I decided we wanted one for the show. We had one years ago, and then the veterans group that made them for us and benefited from their sales, they went out of existence, and we had to find another one. We finally found another one. Each one of those comes with a personally signed thank you card, and I can tell you this, not a penny of the proceeds goes to me. Back in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Portland's news traffic. Lars reads every email. No, really. Talk@LarsLarson.com. That's talk@LarsLarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a First Amendment Friday. I want to raise this question, and it has to do with what the purpose of government is. I mean, before you get to anything else, the CDC or National Parks or Department of Interior, before you get to any of that, it's national security. And at the local level, meaning the state, city, and county level, the number one purpose is public safety. Now, you can sum that up as cops, sheriffs, medical help, and putting out fires. That's just for starters. Get that right. In fact, get that really right, and you've done about 90% of what the public expects of you before you've opened up a single public park or had a DEI conference or any of the rest of that garbage. So when you have major cities, and there are two in the Northwest, Seattle and Portland, that have done a lousy job of providing enough police officers to actually get the job done. Portland now ranks, for example, 47th out of 50 major cities in police officers per capita, and I believe it shows. And one of the people who knows it better than I do is Kevin Neely, executive director of the Oregon Criminal Justice Truth Project. Kevin, welcome back to the program. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing well, but I'd be doing a lot better if major cities in the Northwest actually staffed their policing adequately. And one of the things I always point out to people, I don't have the exact math in front of me, but I'm going to be close. The city of Portland has an annual budget over $8 billion, and they spend well less than one-tenth of that amount on policing and public safety. Now, what does that say about the priorities of the city of Portland if the number one job of local government, which is not DEI and it's not public parks or anything else, it's public safety, and they spend less than a tenth of their budget on it?
Well, we couldn't agree with you more. It should be the number one priority. It has been the number one priority in the past, and it needs to be the number one priority moving forward. And I think you've really hit the nail on the head. If our community isn't spending money on cops, our livability is going downhill fast.
Yep. Well, in fact, you can see that all over. I mean, it's not just downtown Portland, but ought to be the shining example of this represents the city. And yet downtown real estate, the big buildings down there, because people have stopped going there and businesses have been fleeing, the value is down, what is it, 70% in the last few years? So somebody who bought a $10 million building about a decade ago now has a $3 million building, and they can't find tenants to take. I mean, that just sounds like the kind of, you know, crash that you see after a war.
Yeah, it is just a fall from grace, isn't it? And yep. At that exact same time, we've seen this disinvestment in our police. And that's what we're really trying to highlight in this report is, listen, here's what happens. If you don't pay to have safe streets, the livability is going to go down and the economic vitality, particularly of your central city, is going to collapse. And there's probably no better example than some of those cities here in the Pacific Northwest.
Now, I cited that number that came out of your report, the Oregon Criminal Justice Truth Project, 47th out of 50. Do you happen to know where Seattle ranks in there by any chance?
Yeah, I sure do. It's just a few short steps ahead of us. They, too, are here in the bottom 10 with us. Seattle, it looks to me. I'll give you a sense. The bottom here, we've got Seattle, Minneapolis, San Diego, Portland. It's pretty good company we're with right now in the Portland area, isn't it?
All the usual suspects, isn't it? So how do we get that changed, especially when you've got in Portland, both Portland and Seattle, you've got a mayor in Seattle who's a socialist, doesn't sound like she believes in policing. You've got a socialist city council of 12 in Portland and a feckless mayor who doesn't seem to care because, you know, there's a story about him right now in the paper that he goes out on weekends and picks up trash and things like that. But his job was not to run the soup kitchen. His job was to run an $8 billion enterprise. And it sounds like he doesn't have the first clue how to do it.
Well, we sure hope when his budget comes out here in the near future that it protects and preserves the police officers that we do have. But no doubt about it, right? This commission is going to have to, you know, they're going to have to invest some money here. And if they don't invest money in our police, I think it's probably going to end up falling back to the public, unfortunately. And that's not where we should be, but it might be where we are.
Well, and Kevin, one of the things I wonder about is, are you putting individual citizens in the position where when they know that calling 911 means you might get help in a certain period of time, but it's going to be a long period of time, you're basically telling citizens you're on your own. So act on your own behalf, because otherwise you may end up being dead or in the hospital. And I think when people act on their own behalf, instead of, I mean, I'm not faulting it. I'm saying if that's the only choice you've got, then go ahead and take those actions. But it sounds to me like that's going to leave a whole lot more dead or dying criminals out there. And maybe that's what we need.
Well, you know, there's two ways to reduce crime in your communities. Way one is to have more prosecutions. Way two is to have more police officers. And if you err on the side of more police officers, that means you're preventing crime. You just hit the nail on the head. That ought to be our goal. Back when we had over 1,000 police officers in the Portland metro area, the response time on 911 calls was 5 to 8 minutes. Today, you could be waiting 30 minutes before you get a response. That's not the fault of our police departments. They're doing their absolute best. The problem is that our communities are not adequately funding our cops, and that's what needs to change.
Yeah, and all I'm suggesting in giving the numbers at the beginning, when you're spending less than 10%, what's the total police budget now? About $300 million or less?
And that's right. It's right around 300. That's right.
So if you added the police department, the fire department, and then even added in the component that is provided by the private sector for medical response, you'd still be less than $800 million, which would be one-tenth of the budget. And if you say, well, if you're spending less than one-tenth on public safety, what are you spending the other nine-tenths on? And I think the answer is generally stuff. You know, they're spending it on stuff. Are they keeping up with parks? No. Are they keeping up with other infrastructure? No. You know, water, sewer? No. How about roads? No. So where the heck is the money going, Kevin? Do you have any idea?
Boy, we haven't done that examination, but I'm sure smarter people than I have. And you know, the one thing we do know is it's not going to the police department. It's yeah. not going to invest in that foundational need of our community, public safety, right? People just want to be safe before any of those other things come into play. It's really about creating a safe environment for us to thrive. We just don't have that right now in too many parts of our city and, frankly, in too many parts of the Pacific Northwest.
You know, I'm just convinced that with $8 billion plus out there in the city's annual budget, you could divert $100 million to more cops and take it away from whatever, you know, woke, fuzzy thing that they've allocated it to. And probably most people wouldn't give a damn, but they'd be very glad that when you call 911, you get quick response from a cop. That's Kevin Neely, who's director of the Oregon Criminal Justice Truth Project. Back in a moment. You've got the Lars. Crawled into your crawl space.
Missed the Lars Larson Show? Get the podcast right now at LarsLarson.com. Now, more with Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I'm glad to take your calls. If you want to jump in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And should the United States be running secret operations within Mexico? I'd give a qualified yes to that, and I'll tell you why. Because Mexico is the source of so much drug contraband that comes into the United States. And do I think that the Mexican government is necessarily already in the pocket of the Mexican drug cartels? I would say probably so. But this really came to a head this week because two Americans turned up dead inside of Mexico after what appears to be a covert operation gone wrong. And I thought we'd get the details from Christine Balling, who's senior vice president at the Institute of World Politics. Christine, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing well. Great to be back.
Would you mind telling me this? How is it that we find two United States CIA members killed in Mexico after a crash that they've tied back to cartel-related narcotics?
Well, the truth is the Central Intelligence Agency has been assisting in counter-narcotics efforts in countries like Mexico, Colombia, et cetera, for a long time.
No doubt.
So this is really not a surprise, and I think that the reaction that the president of Mexico, Claudia Sheinbaum, has had is largely due to her domestic political priorities. But in any event, yes, CIA operations officers do have in the past done work in country training host nation partners. And so it's no shock to me that of course, I don't know what exactly that they were doing, but the fact that we've got case officers working covertly in Mexico to shore up what should be, as you point out, a much stronger partnership between the United States and Mexico to counter these terrible cartels. It's no surprise. Our country lost two great patriots. I also need to say that.
Yeah, and I think that's important to say. But Christine, do you suppose that when I noticed the same thing you did, and that was Claudia Sheinbaum, the president saying, we have not been informed of any U.S. presence in doing this counter-narcotics activity. Is she saying that because as the president of Mexico has to deal with the cartels, that she has to have sort of plausible deniability, that she knows it's going on, but she has the ability to truthfully say, no, we know nothing about it. Why, we're as shocked as anyone.
Yes, I absolutely, that's it. I think that's it, plausible deniability. And again, in addition, perhaps in terms of the cartels being the audience, are the Mexican people. Politically speaking, she's very left-leaning. She absolutely does not want to be seen as a president who, number one, is friends with the United States, especially with President Trump and the White House. And number two, she doesn't want to reveal the fact that as a head of state, unfortunately, she's unable to protect her country. So yes, I think the plausible deniability was key. And in the most recent reports, apparently she's actually going after the governor of the state of Chihuahua to try to put this all on her. That's where this incident happened. It's right over our southern border.
Well, so, Christine, as long as the cartels have this kind of role in Mexico and they have this kind of hold over the Mexican government at, seems like, almost every level, how do we ever get on top of this problem and stop the cartels from shipping drugs into what has to be one of the most attractive marketplaces for drugs on planet Earth?
Well, quite frankly, by doing exactly what these two brave ops officers were doing, was essentially working on a more local level with the Mexican army. But the bottom line is, to keep doing exactly what we've been doing. And I also like to say that there's no way that the president of Mexico did not realize that the CIA has a presence it's certainly in our embassy. So I think that's another important thing. But the truth is, I think that when President Trump has more than once floated the idea that the Mexicans could use our help, our overt military help, frankly, I think that is exactly what might be needed. Now, whether happen...
But, Christine, is there any way to get... I mean, if you're the president of Mexico and you realize that when you go sideways with the cartels, you're likely to end up dead in a ditch somewhere, can the president of Mexico ever say, yes, why, we'd love to have your help. Send some down right now. Because it sounds like that would be a death sentence for the head of the state, wouldn't it?
Well, possibly. Yes. I mean, I think you're right. She is between a rock and a hard place in that regard. But it also might get to the point where that's exactly what needs to happen. I don't think that she's the president who's going to make it happen. I'm not optimistic about that.
Yeah, or you know, I think what would be worse, Christine, is if they said, sure, we'd love your help. You send your people, we will direct them where they need to go. And then the Mexican government, firmly in the pocket of the cartels, then sends them off to do busy work or sends them off to do something that looks productive, except they're sent to exactly the place they don't need to be, because it would be effectively letting the cartels tell us, where do we put these resources? Oh, we'll put them someplace where they'll work out very, very well. You know, maybe against our adversaries or something.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's the bottom line. I hope that our folks have a real idea as to how high the corruption goes, because that's the real question. As you say, the risk is that if the corruption goes as high as the head of state, then, you know, what can we do? As you say. So, but I'm maybe being a bit naive. I think, again, she wants to stay the president. She wants to get reelected, but I'm very much hoping that she's not truly hand in hand in the pocket with the cartels.
Well, let's just hope that she doesn't also have that fear of, I might end up dead at the bottom of a ditch. That's Christine Balling. Christine is a senior vice president at the Institute for World Politics. Christine, it's a pleasure to have you on the program.
The Lars Larson Show. FM News 101.